KHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina. This is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. As museums challenge their own definitions of inclusive public spaces, the interrogation itself is changing the way they present art. At the Cameron Art Museum in Wilmington, painter and sculptor Thomas Sayer brings new, deeply personal work to his upcoming exhibition, Four Walls. Sayer is probably best known for his massive sculptures in public spaces, such as the Shimmer Wall on the Raleigh Convention Center, Gyre at the North Carolina Museum of Art, and other forms from his earthcasting process, monumental structures made in and of the earth, as he describes them. Four Walls invokes the sacred, but challenges our assumptions about what that means. Sayer says he's exploring the complexity of the human experience as a dance between good and evil. But this new show is also interrogating forms. Grammy-nominated musician Tift Merritt contributed old nightdresses from a now-closed, once-segregated mental hospital, which Sayer has incorporated into his art. She'll also join Sayer within those four walls for an unorthodox musical experience. All of this interrogation of form is leading to new experiences for the public at the CAM. We'll hear from Thomas Sayer and Tift Merritt later in the program about their creative process together and separately. But first, let's meet the Cameron Art Museum's executive director, Heather Wilson, who says, this collaboration perfectly expresses her desire to connect deeply with the community in a safe space. Heather Wilson, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I'm so happy to be here.
It's so good to have you with us. And I do need to say Four Walls opens April 26th, 2024. Your first meeting with Thomas Sayer was serendipitous, miraculous, fateful, emotional. Tell us about how this happened.
Yeah, so in February of 2023, we acquired a work by Thomas called Wild Swans on Cool. And in the process of talking with Thomas about that work, our then director, Ann Brennan, decided and she proposed that we should have a field trip and go to Thomas's studio. So several of us climbed into a rental van and we rode down to Raleigh to see Thomas. You know, I had admired Thomas's work for a long time. I think when you think about North Carolina artists, we think about Thomas Sayer. He's one of the best-known contemporary artists in the state of North Carolina. And so Thomas welcomed us into his studio, which I describe as part alchemist laboratory, part artist studio. And it's also connected to his living space. You know, it's an amazing flow that he has from the studio to his home so that his creative life can be connected so deeply to the life that he has with his wife and his children and grandchildren when they come to visit him. And so we met with Thomas and we...
And this is Ann Brennan is executive director at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're senior staff and there are other members of senior staff there with you.
Yeah, our director,
piled into this rental van.
Absolutely.
And taken a 2.5 hour drive to Raleigh.
Yeah.
To come to this.
There is nothing better than spending time in a working artist studio when you love art. I think learning about process and inspiration can be so fascinating. And I think there was a way in which dialoguing with Thomas helped us to recognize our shared humanity. I mean, I think we often talk in museums about how art can connect us. Sometimes so much that it becomes cliche. But speaking with Thomas and seeing Reredos, which you will get to see in April at Cameron Art Museum, which is a Renaissance altarpiece that he created at the same time his former business partner was dying in hospice. And the story behind it is so powerful. But then actually seeing these works in person, it's quite moving. And so we talked with Thomas about Reredos, which in the place where angels would go in a traditional Renaissance altarpiece, he has these cast of these ethereal floating cast of these hospital gowns from this once segregated mental hospital.
They're angels.
They are angels. They are angels. And at the bottom of the altar are the cast of T-shirts of homeless people that Thomas works with. It is an incredible work of art. So we saw that, and we also looked at Their Solitary Way, which is inspired by the uncanny connection that Thomas found between Paradise Lost and what was happening in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in our country. And having read Milton in college, being able to talk with Thomas about that, it was really illuminating. And I will tell you that that visit that we had, we talk about it, all of us, in this kind of amazing way, because I think we created this collaborative, creative environment in which we were able to share and talk about the art. In some cases, we were moved to tears. It was really an incredible catalyst for what has become Four Walls.
Now, you've talked about making this public space that is the Cameron Art Museum a safe space for everyone. What does that mean to you in a practical sense?
Yeah.
I mean, when is it unsafe?
Mm.
And what policy changes, or what kinds of art, or what are you doing to make it safe?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that there is a movement in museums nationwide. We're thinking about museums as occupying that third space between often work and home that once used to be occupied by civic clubs and places that people used to go to. And there's a way in which museums are becoming that third space. And it's a space for people of all different backgrounds to come together. People in our community have called Cameron Art Museum this inclusive cultural gathering place where they see everyone in our community represented. And that's something that's really important to me. Practically, it means that we're working on an accessibility plan. We're working with a committee of people who are differently abled so that we can make the museum accessible to all. And so that means anyone who might deaf and hard of hearing community, the blind and low vision community, those who are neurodiverse, we are consciously making efforts to make sure that all people feel welcomed. We believe in that adage, nothing about us without us. And so we include the community in our planning and implementation of programming.
When you recently welcomed me into the museum to show me some of the pieces that will be in this new Four Walls exhibition, you were pointing to something else and you called it a maquette. And I said, I don't know what that means. What is that? And that's one of the barriers that I've personally found, because I am not very conversant in visual art, and that is not my world.
Yeah.
And if I've felt like I'm not smart enough to be in that space, I don't understand visual art deeply enough, then what does that mean for other people who might feel even less, you know, sort of at home there?
Yeah, such a great question. We think about that a lot. And we talk about that with, right now I have, I'm putting together a group of people who are helping us with audience engagement, you know, just in that type of line. We want to work on our language so that it doesn't present a barrier, right? Art is for everyone. I think you can see that if you visit the museum right now and you see our current quilt exhibition. It's called The Work of Their Hands. And the exhibition starts with a quilt from our collection that was made by an unknown enslaved woman in the mid-1800s. And from that point, we move forward looking how quilt making has evolved from bed coverings to expressive art. And I think that the great thing about the quilt exhibition is that most of us have experienced the nurturing quality of being enfolded in a quilt that perhaps someone gave you, or maybe even your, like me, I have a grandmother who made quilts for me. And so that's one way we think about when we're planning exhibitions, how can this resonate? And then if we need to, what are the barriers that we need to address to bring everyone to the conversation? Having Spanish language tours has been important for us. We've also provided labels and exhibitions in Spanish, and we've been making a concerted effort to ensure that we are bringing all voices into the art that we have on display.
And just very briefly, you insisted I come to the museum to experience this. You couldn't just send me pictures. Why? Why is standing in that space and experiencing it so important?
Yeah, that's one of the things, you know, we were just talking about how there is something about art that expresses something on a level that we're not able to verbally express.
And that is so well said. You're listening to Coastline. Heather Wilson of the Cameron Art Museum, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Rachel.
Four Walls opens at April 26th, 2024 at the Cameron Art Museum. Coming up in a moment, the artist who created Four Walls, Thomas Sayer. He joins us after this short break. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Thomas Sayer is a sculptor and painter, probably best known for his public art projects, particularly his earth castings. Monumental structures made in and of the earth is the way he describes them. Other examples of his very large public art installations include the Shimmer Wall on Raleigh's Convention Center, where nearly 80,000 aluminum panels depict an oak tree fluttering in the wind. At night, LED lights slowly change colors in what Sayer calls an ode to the sunset. His paintings often incorporate other materials such as gunshots, fire, tar, smoke, earth. Heather Wilson, executive director of the Cameron Art Museum, calls Thomas Sayer one of the most important contemporary artists working in North Carolina today. His new exhibition, Four Walls, opens at the CAM April 26th, 2024. He joins us now from WUNC in Durham. Thomas Sayer, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel. It's nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. Now, you've described this exhibition to me as more personal than most of your work. Why?
Well, it clearly refers to my childhood, growing up in next to Washington Cathedral. It directly comes from going to church for a while. Its content seems more personal to me. All the work is personal. It comes from me, but the abstraction of the work certainly would appear less personal. And there's plenty of abstraction in this work, but come see. I think it would be clear
and
that it's personal.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about your upbringing in and around the National Cathedral in Washington. Many people know that house of worship as the seminal place for Washington, D.C. leaders, a place that conducts their funeral services. Of course, Presidents George H.W. Bush, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan all had their services there. We've seen world leaders memorialized there, Nelson Mandela, Queen Elizabeth II, inextricably intertwined with world leaders. As a child, how aware were you of this connectedness to power in that space?
I was very aware of that. I remember as a young kid, I believe Dwight Eisenhower lay in state there, and I was fascinated by the military personnel that stood by his casket for, I think, four-hour shifts or something like that. And they had guns and bayonets, and I was very aware that this was an important guy laying there with these soldiers around him. But I was also aware that the mission of the church was not just to those folk, but also for people from the street.
And you've explained that the purpose of art in a sacred space, even at this cathedral, wasn't just beauty. That you said most of the congregation in the early days didn't read. And so tell us about the role that the art would have played for the congregation.
Well, the congregation in the medieval times mostly didn't read. I hope they read better now. And so the altar is to launch the message of the church. So there'd be a minister, a male minister, in or around the altar, and then behind the altar was often an altarpiece or a reredos, it's called, that would bring to bear the stories of the Bible with the saints and the sub-saints and the cherubs and the angels, all behind the minister to convey the stories, but also, I think, to convey the power of the church.
So describe what a reredos is, and what do they look like? Or as a kid, what do you remember about them at the National Cathedral?
I remember the box of the altar, the horizontal surface that held the cup, the chalice, and the bread, and all that. And then behind it, in the Washington Cathedral anyway, and many cathedrals, and many non-cathedrals, would be an elaborate carved series of niches, often in which are the depictions of important biblical, usually biblical figures.
And you have created, as part of Four Walls, this exhibition opening at the CAM April 26th, 2024, a reredos is part of this exhibition. When you started to create this piece, how were you going about this? What was it to you? Certainly, it's not a replication in any stretch of what you grew up with at the cathedral.
Well, the overall outline of the piece is a pure Gothic arch, and it started pre-pandemic with the gift. Well, I was sort of messing around with casting garments in concrete, and was given a box of nightgowns that had been used and I think made in at the time, segregated mental hospital here in North Carolina. And I started playing with casting them in concrete. So the mold depicts the negative of the garment. And they looked a lot like angels to me. And so I started thinking about, well, so who are the angels? We know who they were in the medieval times. They came essentially from the Bible. But who are the angels now in a contemporary reredos? And these castings, I think, very squarely ask that question.
And these nightgowns from this long-closed mental hospital, you said somebody gave them to you. It's one of your good creative friends. Can you tell us about her?
Sure. I've been, back in the day, I was a fan of the then touring Tift Merritt, who it was sort of breaking into Nashville and all that. And I was a fan. And many years later, through a mutual friend, I encountered her, and she came to my studio and saw these T-shirts that I'd been casting, and it was a lovely evening with the mutual friend and she and I and my wife and others. And when she left that evening, she said, "I have a present for you." And this box of nightgowns showed up on my studio door a few days later. Quite a gift.
which is now, as you've said, part of the Reredos. And you mentioned T-shirts that also came from kind of a special place that are part of this piece.
Yeah, we needed to complete the pre-pandemic arch itself by referring to the altar and getting the geometry of the Gothic arch off the ground enough so that it, as Gothic architects would say, so that it lofts into the sky. And so I set about to build this kind of reference to an altar that raises the whole thing up 3 feet. And the casting of that those surfaces are of T-shirts which are all looking, you can tell where they're looking by where the necks are of the T-shirts. And they're all looking out as if the audience was looking at the arch. And they are the T-shirts that were worn by street addicts in Raleigh who were welcomed to Healing Transitions, which is an incredibly effective program for addicted people. And they're given new clothes. And the Healing Transitions gave me the original street T-shirts to use. And so, again, it where they came from starts to mess with, so who's the audience or the congregation? Who are the consumers of the messages and the power of the Reredos?
Now, related to this sacred space that you're creating in this exhibition, Four Walls, there are a couple of different pieces depicting a cross, but not the traditional one that we see as the symbol of the crucifixion. Tell us about your crosses, and what are they symbolizing? What questions are they raising?
Well, the crosses started some 20 years ago when I was timidly, more than 20 years ago, when I timidly with a young family stuck our toe back into the pond of being in a church. And this was an unusual and interesting church that I felt moved to respond the way I know how to respond, which is making things. And I made three crosses right in at the weekend of Palm Sunday, which then hung in the church for Holy Week. And these crosses were made, each one, from an act of violence, sawing and shooting and burning. And they were my way of making sense out of the story of the crucifixion, which is not just there's Christ and the bad guys nailed him to a cross. We are in that story. We are the crucified and the crucifiers. And that's my sense of that story. And to realize we are all up in that story is to understand, I think, a often misunderstood part of that Easter story.
So you're really kind of, I mean, in this episode, we're talking a lot about interrogating forms, interrogating traditional forms and givens in public spaces. And you're here really interrogating the idea of, is it fair to say, the definition of the sacred and profane? And I think you said to me when we first spoke that it was re-listening to Paradise Lost that sparked part of this exhibition for you and a question about humanity.
Well, I mean, I hope that this show, I mean, what it has done for me is to help me understand the meaning of the cross, the meaning of ecclesiastical architecture and why it is the way it is. In the case of the Paradise Lost story, which I read as a 19-year-old, a dubious thing for a 19-year-old to read John Milton's Paradise Lost. I came back to that during the pandemic. I'm not sure why, but did, and listened to it while I was making things in my studio for many, many long hours, because that was all there was to do. And it came to me, the truth of what I think a professor said to me way back when I was 19, and that is that it may be the eating of the apple is the first human act, which sets in motion the dance of being human, that we are both angels and the devil together, and our job as a human being is to dance between those sort of hardwired opposites. That may sound a bit sacrilegious, and it probably is to some, but I believe that to be the real meaning of that little short paragraph in the Bible, that which Milton expanded into 400 plus pages.
Now, with the few minutes we have left, I think it's worth noting that, you know, now an internationally recognized visual artist with an honorary doctorate, you have achieved a remarkable level of success. But you didn't take an art class until college?
No.
Well, how did that happen? And tell us about that. And
well,
you were even kind of timid about it.
Well, I certainly was timid about being in an art class or the art world. But what I did bring to the party was, and what I did learn about at an early age, was how to make things. And I learned how to weld when I was in ninth grade. And I learned from my father how to work wood at an earlier age than that, and to respect tools and to return the tools to my father's shop or else. And so I came to the art department knowing how to make things, and that turned out to be a huge advantage. So if making with your hands is your way of expressing things, then it's about connecting that with who you are as a person. And you know, it's a questionable thing to make art at age 19.
But you did have the respect for makers embedded in you at a young age, because you've said in that I'm not sure that we've said this, but your father was dean of the National Cathedral, and you noticed that the makers in the cathedral setting generated such deep respect from queens and presidents and other world leaders. So you knew that was something.
And from my father, yeah, that the guys, and it was mostly guys, but not totally, who were building that place, the carvers, the stained glass window people, the sculptors, the brick masons, the limestone masons, there was a reverence which everybody had for them that was curiously different from the reverence for the people of power. And everyone deferred, really, to the makers in the end, and which I noticed at a very young age. You know, that the presidents who came through, they nodded to the makers in some ways.
And that carried through into your ability as an artist to also be an entrepreneur and charge for your work. You said to me that there was a time you were sitting around a table and threw a number out there that was large because you figured, why would you charge less for your art than the lawyers when you felt they were doing something far less productive? What audaciousness. But audacity, I should say, but you needed that.
Well, if you're going to try to make a living as an artist, you really have to develop some entrepreneurial sense of the world, which is a different set of skills than the making. If you can get away with not living off your art, I would recommend that. But I didn't have a lot of choice. So I developed these other skills and figured, well, if other people are making a living, so can I. And I think what I do is pretty productive.
Yes.
Productive.
Yes, and of course, Gyre is the symbol now for the North Carolina Museum of Art. Yeah. Thomas Sayer, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.
Still ahead, Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Tift Merritt joins us to explore, in part, her role in Four Walls, her new album, and why she says, if you know what you're making, you're not being creative. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Singer-songwriter Tift Merritt found early success in her music career as a touring artist. By 2004, she'd earned a Grammy nomination for Best Country Album. All told, she's produced 8 albums, and she's working on number 9. While that's in the works, she's going to talk with us today about her collaboration, both privately and publicly, with visual artist Thomas Sayer. This public creative cooperation is a progression of what she describes as a creatively nourishing friendship. In a performance within Thomas Sayer's upcoming exhibition, Four Walls, opening at the Cameron Art Museum April 26th, 2024, she will offer 4 original songs in an unorthodox construct. Tift Merritt is also a practitioner in residence at Duke University, where she's working on archival projects that are shaping the new album. She joins us today from WUNC in Durham. Tift Merritt, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so good to have you with us. Now, at Duke University, so you've been working with archives, searching for what I think you described as nonlinear stories.
Well, I search for what I call lyrical presences, which are objects or stories or letters that really require something emotional in response. And I have found, you know, I started working on larger questions just before the pandemic and during the pandemic, much like Thomas was working on larger questions. And I definitely found that linear narrative really is not the way to, it really can't always hold our hardest questions. So a lot of what I'm doing is putting things beside each other and seeing how they talk to each other.
Can you give us an example of one of those harder questions that you've been exploring?
Frankly, all of this started when I was driving by the former asylum in my hometown, which was being reconstituted as a public park. And I thought, that's strange that we didn't look over there for 200 years, and now we're all going to, like, have Sunday picnic and play Frisbee there. Somebody should write something about that. And then I went, oh, no, it's me. and so, it's, you know, I started collecting objects on the grounds there, and I started going back and looking at old intake records and, you know, volunteer archives and just trying to set things beside each other. I maybe one of the starkest things that I found was a moth that was caught in this gigantic intake record. And, you know, it was a certain kind of inventory of someone who of something that is trapped in an institution. So, you know, I think there are a lot of accidental monuments that we find in human life, and it's really important to ask those things what they need to sing.
Yes. Now, you talk a lot about the creative process and how it needs to feel like you're being expanded. Like there's no point in staying in the box that you've already made or that the world has determined is your box. No point.
I mean, I wish that I could stay in a box. I would be a much more convenient human being if I could just stay in the line that was given. But, you know, for me, I think it's really important to pursue questions and without prerequisite answers. And I think it's really important to pull on those places where what is prescribed about form limiting and that how, you know, how, what can we learn from different types of storytellings? What are the limitations of, you know, 3 minutes in a song or, you know, this is how a concert's supposed to be. I just think when you start asking big questions, there's a natural asking questions of the form and how do you deliver a story most effectively? And you know, I find that that's really interesting and fascinating and also helps me become a better storyteller.
And you've described in the past your songs as sonic short stories. So for those folks who may not have heard Traveling Alone, we're going to play a little bit of that. But what story does this song tell?
Oh, this song tells the story of, you know, needing to being alive long enough to get watered down and needing something of a compass to sing to myself about who I am and what I believe in every night.
All right, good. Let's listen.
This morning, if it always gone, funny thing, wouldn't faze me none. Might feel like I just got home. You know I always had a taste for traveling alone. I only get this one time around. Better speak up straight. Better speak up proud. Good Lord, if he's not at home, well, I always had a taste for traveling alone. Oh, if I had a son, I would make him laugh. I would teach him something. Say, son, you gotta hold your own, and it's good to have a taste for traveling alone. Oh, if I had a love, I would say, to lay down, baby, feed my soul, 'cause you know I got a taste for traveling alone.
Tift Merritt, Traveling Alone. Tift, when you decided to stop touring, which you decided because you didn't want your daughter's childhood to be lived on the road, but that was a really scary place to explore. And that was kind of an example of your insistence on staying in that creative new space because there was this risk you felt that maybe your music wouldn't survive it. But what happened as a result of that risk?
I mean, I it's such a surprise. When my daughter was almost two, I she and I came home from touring a record and being on tour in Europe, and I just knew, looking at this wonderful little person, that she needed roots, and that this was not the life that was going to be okay for her. Which is such a funny thing, I think, as a mother, as women, you are kind of willing to go through certain things yourself, but you're not willing to do that to right. your child. And for me, it was a very clear decision. But it was also very scary, because I was pretty sure that that meant that I was closing the door on a certain creative life that had really, been the fiber of my life and what I thought my meaning was. And, it turns out that an enormous amount of creative doors opened for me outside of this very narrow box of making records and touring.
Yes.
And my daughter really, that decision, my daughter really gifted me that. And, I think there is so much work in being an artist that is private, that is deeply rooted, that is not performance. And it's also just given me a larger space and a larger framework to work with when I'm not putting myself into just a 3.5-minute song or just a tour where I'm, performing for an hour and a half a night. It's been a surprise and very rewarding.
And you talk about this private part of the creative process. And an example that I think you shared with me, visual artist Thomas Sayer and your friends, you have this creative friendship that seems to feed both of your art forms. You have conversations with him sitting on the floor in his office. You talk about how you're both plain spoken and you want your work to be approachable. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's, I think there are so many reasons that Thomas and I have a really meaningful friendship. But it is interesting how we locate ourselves in very parallel places in different forms. And I love how Thomas talks about he is not of this art world where your work is supposed to confound and put off the viewer, that he really wants his work to be approachable and expansive and plain spoken. And I always say that I want, I want my lyrics or my writing to be something that, you find on a postcard from your mailbox, or you say to, it's as simple as a conversation between you and the person that you're checking out with at the grocery store, and just the everyday beauty. And I think that there are a lot of parallels between what I don't know in the landscape of the art world and the landscape of the music world, and what works and what doesn't, what's confounding, what's meaningful, and to be able to share making a road of your own with your friend is really deeply meaningful.
And you guys are going to be doing a collaboration of sorts. You'll be performing within his sacred four walls at the Cameron Art Museum, and you're interrogating the forum. You've said it doesn't necessarily have to be an audience sitting in a fixed space while the artist, you, is up in front of them, singing to them.
Yes.
You're thinking about ritual.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I think the world needs a lot more of its artists and singers than like looking cool on your Instagram. And when you start thinking about what songs really are and what they really can do, and as you move air around, it is healing, it is ritual, it is high-minded speech, and how can we pursue those things in different ways? And somehow I talked Thomas into doing this with me. And it's been really interesting to, you know, to think about the space itself, but also to think about the form of a song, which is really interacting with a visual. So it's very different. You know, when we listened to Traveling Alone, for instance, that is completely, that song needs to be complete in and of itself. And there's no visual, there are no other parts. The sound has to tell the whole story. But when you're interacting with a sculpture or a painting or something that Thomas has burned, you know, that part of the story, that is already in existence. So it doesn't need to happen sonically. It's just a lot of room to move in when you are in a band with a painting. And it's been really fun to sit on Thomas's floor and to bring him versions of what we're making together and to see what affects him and what is clutter. It's just a wonderful experiment. And I think it's really important to take sound into new spaces and interrogate the ways that we listen and perform.
So one of the tunes that you've written for this collaboration is called Paradise Lost. And I don't know that we can listen to a few seconds of this. And again, it's a demo.
Talking to the apple, talking to the apple, standing at the eastern gate, talking to the apple.
And that's part of the demo Paradise Lost by Tift Merritt. And Tift, I know you probably want to briefly say something about what a demo is and the purpose of it.
Did you hear the car go by?
I thought that was outside our studio.
No, that was in there. That was in my condenser mic in my office. A demo is not a final product, but, you know, one hopes that they stand up and speak for themselves to a certain extent. I mean, I was so taken when Thomas was telling me about making Paradise Lost during the pandemic and thinking about lapsed ideals and the moment that we become human and this apple as the witness and kind of like trying to get to the primary source, you got to go back and talk to the apple. Like, wait a second. And, you know, I think those questions of what makes us human and when we began being human and, you know, those are so pertinent to everything that's happening around us right now, whether it's how are humans capable of such inhumanity or, you know, what is going to be the difference between us and an AI person, you know, singing a song before too very long. So I really wanted the apple to give me some answers.
And we'll hear that inquiry in Paradise Lost. That is this edition of Coastline. Tift Merritt, thank you so much for being with us today.
What a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks also to Thomas Sayer, Heather Wilson, and the folks at WUNC. And just a brief personal message. This is actually the second to last new episode that we'll record. I'm leaving WHQR with one more new episode coming up in 2024, and I leave with a heart full of gratitude. You, the Coastline community, engaged with us in the beginning when this was a live broadcast, and we took calls, emails, tweets, and Facebook comments. When we went to the pre-recorded edition, you continued to offer your ideas and questions, which is gold since this show is really about you and your community. Over the years, you've challenged me about what I was doing and why I was doing it. You often wrote in with feedback, sometimes hard to hear, but always precious to me. You have been my teachers, my friends, my community. From where I sit, It's a deeply worthwhile collaboration that I will always treasure. Thank you for listening. I'll see you around. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.